Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome to the AEW Dynamite Review. I'm Adam Wilborn from What Culture, joined by the Dudley Boys of What Culture, Michael Hamplett and Michael Sidgwick, here to review everything that happened on last night's episode of AEW Dynamite. But before we get into it, if you're a fan of this sort of thing, make sure you subscribe to What Culture Wrestling on either iTunes, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts from, for daily wrestling podcasts, where we not only review AEW Dynamite, but also UMP, baby, Raw, SmackDown, NXT, pay-per-views, premium live events. We have interviews, roundtable discussions, and a round of the week complete with the Bodega Quiz, of course, on wrestle culture. As I said, though, joined by Hamplett and Sidgwick to review the go-home episode ahead of Double or Nothing of AEW Dynamite. How was it for you, Sidge?
It was a good show with good things on it, one great thing on it. I don't know if it's just my personal mood. I don't know what it is, but I just didn't stop watching and feel an enormous amount of buzz and enjoyment and anticipation ahead of the pay-per-view, or B, I didn't realistically have that much to say about it. There was stuff I enjoyed, but like not in a way I was like, I really like that detail, or that was such a great move, or that was such an electrifying match that just clicked that I loved. I just didn't feel a great deal for it, and I know that can sometimes be annoying because we're meant to articulate what's good or bad or whatever about this, but that ultimately is a problem for me. Look, I don't know if it's just my malaise or a totally subjective thing, but before I pass on, I noticed something the other day, right, where I tried to tweet, this is, I think, what's wrong with AEW and my subjective enjoyment or lack thereof at the moment with this product, right? And I did it. I tweeted it. And usually, when you say something to the effect of, oh, 8.5 out of 10 Dynamite, but this segment was awful and, you know, there was a lull at this bit, we'll go, dickhead, it was a 10.
goodbye, 50 followers.
Goodbye, 50 followers. Well, why didn't you think it was a 10 out of 10?
Do you remember when we got absolutely bodied that few weeks where we were like, hey, AEW's got a bit off the rails here?
One thing I've noticed is that when I tweeted that, I didn't mind the deluge. I'd just rather stick to my guns, express an honest opinion, and just have it out there.
Pure heart rule, I think it's called.
It's one of those, yeah. It's one of those where I don't expect the WWE fans who have completely at this point just driven away to go, you know what, maybe I was wrong about that situation. Maybe he's a fair and partial critic, and I will hold him in the esteem of the highest wrestling media types. I don't think this is going to happen. I would just rather be principled about the whole thing. I was expecting a deluge of, dickhead, it's the best thing ever. Maybe you need to take some time off, or something like that. Loads of people agree. Like, just absolutely loads of people. So I don't necessarily think it's just a subjective.
Malaise feels like a good word to describe how I feel about it right now.
Yeah, it is a malaise, right? And I'm writing an article which should be on What Culture at some point in the next day or two. So please look out for it. It's about the size of the roster. And I'm watching every single segment of an AEW Dynamite show. And I'm thinking you can either build a promotion around one person in the segment or one person in the segment doesn't feel as hot or as big or as huge as they once did, even 6 months ago, because there are too many people in each segment who I feel this way about. They've streaming serviced the water cooler TV show.
Sounds like a great article that they should get someone really good to present that as a video. That's what I think.
Yeah, me too.
I mean, I just like watching that happen there. Game the system. I thought this was mostly bad. But, like, apparently the expectation now when talking about AEW is that we've got to be the BBC again. So should I just say it was mostly good as well? And then people can take my subjective opinions as well. Like, come on, guys, what are you doing? What's the purpose? Well, so apparently what we've got to do for this podcast is let Wilborn recap what happened in the matches, say who won and who lost, and then me and Cedric will chip in to be like, yes, that wrestler won. Yes, that wrestler lost. And that's our job, apparently, as reviewers. Like, the idea that, like, for a while...
And to be impartial, Jobber Nation TV is going to join us.
Yeah,
in
no.
I laboured over when NXT was, like, dying in front of my eyes. Look what they've done to my body. I'm not talking about 2.0. That saved the whole thing. When it was dying from sort of early 2020 onwards, I went back to the well a lot of feel, not think, right? I wanted to feel for this product what I no longer did. Instead of just thinking, oh, these 3.5-star matches are good wrestling matches. Who cares about that, right? And then now you're getting bollocked for feeling instead of thinking, oh, what does it matter what you feel this for? Well, with respect, like, what do you want? Do you want us to just say, well, I think what happened in that match is what happened? Like, that's not yeah. That's not reviewing. That's not, like, and to Cedric's point about, like, being able to articulate my thoughts, I watched last night's episode, and the first thoughts that sprung to mind after it was finished were, I don't think that was a super effective, here I am thinking and not feeling. I don't think that was a super effective go-home show. I don't think everything bar one really great angle was particularly well serviced. I don't think most of these pairings are, like, the right pairings, or the pairings that feel the hottest they could be, if you look up and down the Double or Nothing card, and I don't think Dynamite has done much to address that. I don't think the Owen tournament's been a success. And on and on and on it goes of things that I don't think have been as effective as they have been. So if I just say that instead of, I don't feel like much of this is any good, is that better? I don't know if this is and I appreciate for some people this is like laborious, but is this like a laborious debate on how it is that you criticise a product that up to this point has felt like it's so in service of its fan base that at any point at which people feel malaise, as you put it, for the first time, is that just too much for people to want to take or want to accept? There's a core of people that probably still love this for, mm-hmm. for everything it is without considering what it could be. Like, so the noise in the opening segment was not replicated throughout.
No.
Was my feeling throughout watching the show. Somebody has the right to disagree with that very subjective take, this subjective take that we are giving on a review and some critical analysis of a wrestling show. But, like, the noise and the heat and the feeling and the vibe of the opening segment was not replicated throughout, when typically AEW would work to about a 90-10 ratio of things that had that. And I joked about it a couple of years back. It reminded me of living, like, in a shared house with people, and there always being that one housemate that nobody liked as much. And it was like, well, that's good, because my smaller feelings are nothing compared to the magnified ones of this poor bullied person. AEW was kind of booked like that. There's always that one story, like, if it wasn't just for this, everything would be perfect. The Double or Nothing card is like, thank God for this, in terms of MJF Wardlow, rather than everything else.
Yeah.
Like, it was Cody for a while, wasn't it? Like, AEW is amazing. Cody versus is kind of weird, but otherwise, AEW was great. And then it was, like, Sammy a little bit, or it was the Dark Order in 2019 or whatever. I wouldn't say they've gone 90-10 in the opposite direction, but the good is strictly good. Mm. It doesn't feel great, and I'd say that without apologies to those that are still loving these episodes of Dynamite, because fantastic.
Yeah.
Love these episodes of Dynamite. Feel as I wish I did for the pay-per-view on Sunday. That's the other thing as well. It's a pay-per-view week. AEW pay-per-view week feeling used to be amazing. AEW pay-per-view week used to make me feel like when I was at school in the Attitude Era. So, like, WWE are making this very, very adolescent wrestling for a very, very adolescent me. And I'm an absolute fever pitch for virtually everything in my life because I'm 13 years old. And then they're booking sex and violence and all this sort of stuff on a Sunday. AEW had captured that for millennials, and I don't think they've done it this time around. You know, I also don't want to be made a hypocrite if I like the show on Sunday. They're still doing good stuff. I think they're capable of better. I think they're capable of much better. There's lots on this Dynamite that spoke to what I think is a distinct lack of focus this last few months.
You said this often in the NXT days, didn't you, about takeovers?
The parallels are becoming eerie at this point. There's nothing that's emotionally drawing me into these stories. Yet the match quality is absolutely in no doubt whatsoever, except, and this is a nice little segue for the people who might have alienated at this point, I think there's a match on this card where people are going to go, yeah, the build wasn't great, but the match is going to be great, and I'm genuinely actually worried about that. So it's actually going to get even more critical. So look forward to that imminently.
And we've got another podcast, Look Ahead to Double or Nothing,
yeah,
later on today as well. That's going to be fun. Do you know what the real litmus test is?
Mm.
When was the last time you ate cereal and stayed up and watched AEW Dynamite?
Oh, yeah, ages ago.
You have to think about it.
Ages ago. I couldn't miss a week at one point because I was just so, like, they'd big graphics drops at 6 p.m. our time, and it's like, well, it's only 7 hours to Dynamite now. I might as well. Yeah. I made that conscious choice.
Was it Punk Dax or something like that? Or something you
saw? That feels right, yeah. Because I can't remember if I bothered with the Dax and Cash. I don't think I did.
Mm.
Cards haven't been overall strong enough.
But yeah, there's a personification of the up and down nature of this show was in the opening segment. The only down is that Piggy's going to the pay-per-view. I'm joking, of course. I'm just doing the gimmick. Wardlow, let's talk against Shawn Spears in a steel cage match with Shawn Michaels. Sorry, MJF as the special guest referee. Those shorts, man.
Wish I'd got... There's AEW in a nutshell. I wish I'd called the booty shorts that Sean used to wear to ride up the locker room, and I didn't, because this company and the performers within it can still do better than the podcasters.
And how did we not get the Burberry stripes?
Yeah, like, this. How often did we do that? Here's our three predictions that is definitely going to happen. We've got three better ones. Yeah. Like, that should be the bar that every segment aims for.
Yeah, surprise, surprise. This was just great stuff. So MJF comes out, as I mentioned, in the booty shorts and the Burberry referee outfit. Wardlow's cuffed and he's flanked by security. No music, none of that. Shawn Spears has his entrance as well, and he's waiting there in the ring, and he's brought a chair with him just in case. But unfortunately, before the match, MJF lost the key for Wardlow's cuffs. So Spears just immediately jumps in and attacks him, and he's got his hands cuffed throughout the time. And MJF decides, I'm going to stick a view on him as well. They drive Wardlow into the cage. Wardlow does make a comeback whilst he's handcuffed, which did look great. And MJF's like, just go on, just chin me just once. He's desperate, a bit like he was with Cody. Just, you know, lay one finger on me so I do not have to face you on Sunday at the pay-per-view. He spits in his face, and then Wardlow doesn't hulk up. He abysses up in a segment that me and Hamlet were talking about recently. Bursts out of the handcuffs, beats up Spears, swantons onto him, covers him. MJF goes down. I was going to say one, but he doesn't even do one. He just pops his head on his chin and just looks at him like he's in some, you know, photo shoot for a calendar or something. So Wardlow's just furious. He sets up for the Powerbomb Symphony on Spears, but MJF kicks him in the bollocks. Spears hits the C4. 1-2. Oh, it's still not quick enough. Wardlow kicks out despite MJF's fast count.
So fast.
Yeah, it was so bad.
Great.
And there was also a split second when Shawn Spears left the cage where I thought they were doing a gimmick where Spears was back in his old WWE days and was like, is that not a win? Because I've left the cage. But he's actually getting out there to get the chair. He gets in there. We can all see what's about to happen. MJF's holding Wardlow up for him to be clonked on the head. But at the last second, Wardlow moves and Shawn Spears clobbers MJF with the chair. He goes down. Spears, who, if you haven't watched The Road to... His promo in that is just jaw-dropping. His face here of just like, oh, bollocks. And he's there, and he can't believe what he's done. And they have that shot that we orgasmed about when it was it Drew and Taker or someone like that?
The rising up.
Yeah. Wardlow appears just behind him. And this, he's just like, well, we all know where it's going from here. Wardlow pulls the straps down, Powerbomb Symphony. I think he hits three, and... down to the ring, runs Bryce Remsburg, and the final powerbomb is Spears onto the chair. 1-2-3. Wardlow gets MJF at the pay-per-view on Sunday. And afterwards, every single one of the security runs in. And understand them, they do it one by one because they have to get into the ring. So this isn't just stupid, just why are you all going one at a time? Because there's only one way to get in, and they just run, clobber, run, knock you out. And then the last one, Wardlow... power bombs him onto the cage, but like I saw a great tweet that said like Wardlow put him in the shadow realm because he got thrown into the cage and then slid down, but there was the gap between the ring and the steel cage, and he just disappeared. And Wardlow climbs to the top of the cage, great visual, and points well either at the double or nothing sign or at MJF, and MJF's just like, I'm buggered here. Great stuff. This
was great. I'm gonna be a pedantic. Tiny bit pedantic about this. I still think, I don't want to say it was rushed, because I never got the feeling of you're not getting enough out of this, but I did think they could have got more out of it. I don't know, I just think if they'd paced it, and it's again, it's the problem with the show, there's too many things that need to be accommodated on the show, so that certain things feel a little bit rushed.
Do you think maybe that's because some people have suggested, and I don't think we've said it, but I've certainly heard other people say, oh, they've been a bit indulgent with the MJF segments, and they've just gone, right, what's the strategy here? What are we trying to achieve?
I just think that's...
But he's the best part of the show, I agree.
It's the best part of the show. It's the thing that people most care about. They could have drawn out the drama. There's just more to play with, because what you've got to play with is so hot, it's so great, it's so ingenious is the word, that I just think that I wanted to enjoy it for 3 minutes more. Maybe that's greedy, or maybe they've just missed a slight trick, or maybe they shouldn't have signed 10 of the wrestlers that they've signed of late and have now had to accommodate. But this is great. And again, mine and Hamford's big thing is we want to be stupid marks who talk about this and love talking about it because we love it. We fantasy book stuff and then they do something much better. Or they do something that we haven't thought of because they are better than us and they know it. The key thing, genius. What an absolutely beautiful deal, because it makes you think that MJF's actually outsmarted Wardlow all along and had that idea since the conclusion of Revolution. But no, Wardlow is just too strong, too much of a badass. There's just so many cool details here that I loved. It was very economical. I might be contradicting myself here because those 3 minutes, I don't know how you spend them. All I know is that I could have done with three more. Do you patronize me by saying Sean Spears is going to get a heat spot? Because that wouldn't ring true. So, but they didn't do that either. It was just a relentlessly cathartic thing that could have maybe had a little bit more drama to it. But when it's so fun, you do feel pedantic and you don't really care. And that is the part where you can actually park that part of your brain and think, you know what, I still thought this was great.
And the other thing is, as well, when you like something as much as we all like this, how many times have we sat here and delved into a moment that arguably, you know, a casual fan may just think, oh, that's just something that happened. But because we are invested in it, when Wardlow broke out of the cuffs, I didn't think, well, why hasn't he done that before? And he was getting hit with the belt or getting kicked in the bollocks. And then I thought, no, if you had that power, why would you do that then? Because you know you've already got a steel cage match to come. You do that at the last hurdle to be like, right, now you're buggered. So
it's like a trap. It's a smart baby face laying a trap.
A baby face is a smart in AEW.
Yes.
On that, actually, I didn't share those points that Cedric made about the time. I just felt it got all it needed. And maybe it's sort of, I'm being generous here, because so much on Dynamite hasn't felt like it's got all it needed lately, that this, the mere fact that Wardlow's on the cage, MJF selling on the ramp, and we're not just immediately, right, let's get out of here, was quite refreshing, I suppose. But I had my own sort of pedant moment where we talked about this in the previous episode, I would have quite liked if Wardlow had used MJF's hand to strike the three.
Yeah.
But the longer I thought about it, the more I started to like what they did. It was Bryce Remsburg.
Yeah.
Came in a minute. I quite liked it. It was another referee that came in, because the more I was willing, this is all my headcanon, but the good angles are supposed to give you things to that you want to think about or imagine that are true, even if it's just things that you're projecting on the product. I wanted to think, well, we've been told that Wardlow's not really got a friend in the world backstage because of all the times he was having to help MJF. But does Bryce Remsburg reflect the first time that at least one person has gone, oh, but MJF is a dick and he has this coming, as we've seen before.
He let Cody use the weight belt.
The awesome Turner it was.
Oh, bollocks.
But the idea that even the referees hate.
Yeah.
All the referees hate MJF, but they're kind of stuck with him as a wrestler. But at this point.
Do you reckon he changed in the referee locker room?
Who?
MJF.
Again, imagine that he did. And imagine that he just booted them all out of their locker room so that he could have the whole thing to himself. You can pretend all these things and they're just fun to think about, right? But this idea that Bryce Remsburg hates him that much, as all the referees do, that even though he too has got his own issues with Wardlow, that he looks at that and thinks, I'll have some of that. I want this to happen. I want MJF to suffer that. I can infer that and it not be that far away from what was presented to me. And I quite like that as a result. One thing, and I don't want to pollute the waters here, because I have my own personal opinions on this, but they can get skewed. It's telling to me that people are so invested in this story. And if they are talking about issues with AEW, they're centered around Punk Page and other things on Double or Nothing that I haven't seen, could be my curated timeline, haven't seen a load of discussion on a full-on chair shot to the head. Because, yes, it might have been a gimmick chair, like the Cody one was, and Cody bled everywhere, which is, of course, his visual representation of, well, even if it's gimmick, does it really matter? What is it you're showing? They've just done one, a big one, a completely unprotected, hands-down chair shot to the head. I don't like them, and it's not... I'm probably softer-centered. I don't like that you normalise something and it gets copied again and then it just exists. And then we all wring our hands in 5 years when there's loads of CTE or some awful thing that occurs. But it happened, and it really made sense within the context of what we were watching. It was very, very earned. Very earned.
And very over as well.
Super over. If you think of Sean Spears, if you think of what Wardlow was going through in the moment, there has been very little in the way of the minging bad faith discussion that normally accompanies things like that. But I credit the storyline. I think people are so into the storyline. I think people were swept up in that chair shot being, I might not like it, but I actually can see the narrative justification for it.
I don't think, this speaks to a wider point that I'm trying to make about AEW right now, I don't think we've seen a full-on chair shot to the head since Blood and Guts, when they decided to go full ham with it to really try and... It was a shortcut to the tone, but it was an effective one because it just genuinely felt like this ultra-violent, shocking thing until the finish. But because you haven't seen chair shots to the head ad nauseum for months and months and months, it did resonate as a special, dramatic, scary, cathartic, whatever moment. That's because they haven't done it 1 million times.
How do you follow that? I tell you, I'm Jericho Appreciation Society, walking around backstage, walking up to a bloke working there in a Moxley t-shirt, and he gets a fireball in his face because Jericho's a wizard. I just like, perfect palate cleanser, that, for me. Loved it.
Wade Keller made a great point. Why is someone who is effectively trying to hospitalise and disfigure both members of the roster and members of AEW staff allowed to commentate on Rampage? It's one thing that he doesn't get fined. He, in fact, gets more money for a second job. That's Wade Keller's take, not mine. I want to put that out there because I think it's a great one.
I didn't like this. I'm a wizard. It's funnier when he's done this fireball overreach once. Like, I'm a wizard. Like, the threat of Chris Jericho calling himself a wizard and chucking a fireball at you is funny. Chris Jericho running around and fireballing innocent people. You're not a wizard. You're a criminal and you're weird. Like, I get it. I think that they, like... So I think they underwrote the reaction to Kingston getting fireballed. And that should have been...
Sucks for that guy. Here comes Rampage.
Yeah, like, that was very much the tone of Kingston getting...
Well, he might never see again, but if you want to see something, Rampage is ready.
It's like, oh my God, what did Chris Jericho do? I don't care, because I don't know him. Anyway, on to the next. is that the line? Is that the... Well, he was just a complete stranger to me.
To be honest, they could do that to my gran, and I'd be like, yeah, he's a wizard.
He's a wizard, gran.
You really love it, don't you?
Tough tits, gran. He's a wizard. Just, he told you he was a wizard.
It was the trifecta. Do you know what it was, the trifecta? And... it was Daddy Magic trying to like intimidate him. Cool Hand Angel, and I don't know if he's had this the whole time or not, but a comb. I love him. like he's something out of West Side Story or something. Like, ooh, I'm going to slick my hair back because I'm dangerous. And then Jericho's just like, what if I throw fire in your face?
Like, that's actual danger. It's. Do you see what I mean? Like, it's a bit tonally dissonant of these guys being like, we're more wacky than anything else with our combs and stuff. But then he actually does the thing.
I love it.
They're walking down like the hall backstage and Jericho's like, yeah, I'm a wizard. And then like he aims for people, but he misses. So like he just fires a fireball out and somebody goes running for some stagehand runs to the hills. And they're like, whoa, Jericho. And then he's got another one. Like somebody else goes running. I'm a wizard. He's just, theoretically, Jericho might fireball you is the joke. Him like burning someone's face off backstage is for real.
That's
like,
very good at it, and it's a pretty hard thing to do, as we've seen Hulk Hogan. Yes. Maybe he's just buzzing off the fact that is this the first fireball stuff he's ever done in his career?
Yeah.
Maybe he's just buzzing that he's done it and he's just nailed it first time and he's like, I'm a wizard.
Fireballs at the next Fozzy gig.
Yeah.
Plus, I saw someone tweet this. It's been LTST, let's not forget. Stadium Stampede. To which then, now he's a wizard.
Yes. It was the best. Oh, that was the best. It was the pandemic and it was the best.
Yeah. Right, let's talk about this face-to-face between the AEW World Champion Hangman Page and CM Punk.
I'm going to get lunch.
As we predicted.
The Luton manager's like, you better bring your dinner. You're going to get such a bollock in this.
This was done rather than with Jim Ross in a taped backstage segment in the centre of the ring with Tony Schiavone. They both come down, both make their entrances, and Punk talks about the fact that his biggest moment of his career happened in Las Vegas, and he was going to walk out of Double or Nothing as champion. Page said there's nothing Punk could do to him to take the title away, and Punk's just poking the bear a little bit, saying, I don't know why you're taking things so personally, mate. It's just business. He's been watching some Tony D'Angelo promos, clearly. Page said when I talked
about... Promos by who?
Tony D'Angelo, you schmucks.
How would the Dark Order speak if they were Tony D'Angelo's assistants?
Tony Dark Order. That's the Stacks and Two Dimes.
I'm the meat man.
Evil Uno, what are you doing? Anyway, Page said when he talked about an
Preston Vance.
When he talked about annihilating an embarrassing Punk, he didn't mean a double or nothing. He meant right now, and he'd fantasized about dropping a... What was it?
Pipe bam.
You hate that, don't you?
Pipe bam. They killed it. I don't particularly blame Punk for that, but it's just when he was a literal mic drop, wasn't it? Pipe bam. Why are you making me go off here?
Yeah, he said he wanted to do that. He wanted to let one of them off in Punk's face, but now he just can't do it. He can't do it because that's exactly what Punk would do, and it's wrong. He says, look, I don't hate you, Punk. In fact, I almost pity you. I don't think you've got what it takes to be a champion, because it's not just about holding this belt. It's about everything else. It's about little moments. It's about what goes on outside of the ring as well. Paige talked about his love for this place. And he said, at Double or Nothing, he'll be defending AEW from CM Punk. And again, Punk reiterates, well, I don't know why you're so angry all the time. If you're so upset about me being here, you're going to have to do something about it this weekend. And he talked about the house that Paige built being made from the wood that Punk had chopped down. The roads that he traveled were paved by CM Punk. He gave AEW the blueprint, et cetera, et cetera. And he said, you know what? You are going to shake my hand on Sunday. And shake my hand right now. And he pushes it in his chest, and Paige doesn't want any part of that. And eventually they get into a bit of a shoving match, and Paige clobbers Punk with her right hand to drop him to the mat. And he just feels that for a second, and it feels like he's got, I'm not going to say rent free, but he's making Paige fight emotionally, which is the way he thinks he's going to be victorious. There's been a lot of debate, but I've already seen tweets from you guys about this online this morning, about this and what they're attempting to achieve. Did they achieve it for you here?
I think this is an amazing story, and I'm just glad we've got 3 more weeks for the pay-per-view to build it and explain it and flesh it out. Like, this sort of stuff has made me think, well, there's got to be a rematch after this, because Hangman Page, I put it to Cedric this morning over the desks, he's opened Pandora's box and then he snapped it on your fingers just as you go to peer inside. Like, all the mentions of the things speak to something. But what that something is, we don't really know. We've just talked about with the MJF Wardlow thing. It's okay to infer the odd one or two things, right? But Hangman Page asked us to infer so much about CM Punk there that hasn't even been remotely clued in on it. He could be foreshadowing an incredible CM Punk heel turn, right? An incredible one. And then down the line, Hangman Page has proven that he was the conscience and the cornerstone of AEW all along, and he could see what nobody else could. But we had to see it for ourselves. Like, tell me, like, if you really feel this way, you have earned my respect and you have earned my trust, my loyalty. So tell me and explain this to me, and you know, don't necessarily leave that to be inferred, because whatever it is, I'm not believing all of it because I'm still massively with Punk. I think that's a big and a bold story to tell, and they've told big and bold ones with Hangman Page before. So I'm not stupid. I feel like I know what I'm supposed to be watching, but I don't think the delivery was particularly good. I don't think the timing of it was that great. I think the 50-50 reactions in the building are nice on paper, but actually less than ideal in practice, because you could see here that whenever, like, the natural turn to, I know they were trying to make it feel like a conversation, but the natural turn taken of pro wrestling was almost derailed by the differing fan reactions. So I don't think that was particularly helpful either. And I just don't know that whatever was touched upon here and then left well alone so they could get to the, Punk, I wanted you to hit me, now I know that I've got you. Like, they could have arrived at that in a more simple fashion. And if they really did want to hit this stuff, they should have hit it weeks ago. I was saying weeks ago, like, okay, Hangman, you're really pissed off with CM Punk. It's probably time to tell me why. And then you never do until you're face to face. Like, there are people online being super patronising and condescending about this. I know it's online, we're reviewing a TV show, not Twitter. But there are people online suggesting, like, come on, guys, if you don't get what this is all about, then you're the thing. And I was like, no,
I don't get it.
I don't agree with it as well. I think it's absolutely fine, shock of all shocks, to try and sell your title fight like a title fight, regardless of all the inferences and the little character details that you're being asked to pick up on. This was fine. But this is this is Hangman Page versus CM Punk. I still think this will draw enormously. CM Punk fighting for the title, I think, is going to do huge numbers for them. And I don't think they've even scratched the surface of what it is they could have done together.
I don't think they've even scratched the surface of what on earth they're on about. This is absolutely wildly unfocused to me. I would love nothing more in 2 months for the penny to finally drop and go, oh, that was great, and I wish I'd let it play out. I don't get this at all. Not only do I not really get this, but I don't think lingering over what it might be is going to have a positive impact on the match. I've read a lot of people saying, I don't really get what they're going for here. And ultimately, everyone has had the same opinion. And I don't think it's copium. I think it's a well-reasoned take. You've got CM Punk in one corner, Hangman Page in the other. How can it not be a bad match? Bad builds create bad matches. Like, genuinely, AJ Styles versus Edge. It's not as bad as that. Is it as bad as this? I don't know. People just thought, oh, it's AJ Styles and Edge. That should be a great match because it's got two great wrestlers in it. It's simply not as... It's not as if AJ and Edge went on last after, like, 5 hours. And it's like, all right, okay, the crowd just aren't. The crowd weren't invested in the story or didn't know what to make of the story, so they did not give a toss about the match, irrespective of the talent and star power involved.
Yeah.
I'm actually very worried. I was a little bit worried because that dissonance between CM Punk and Hangman Page, in terms of their physical styles, there's going to have to be some kind of wavelength compromise there, and whether they can click into that immediately is another issue. Like, Hangman Page is this incredibly athletic, propulsive, powerful guy with an engine like no one else. CM Punk, and this is great, is the sweat-soaked, like, abdomen-puffing sort of, like, old guy who's wily. Like, they're going to have to pace this impeccably to sort of make it feel like Punk's, like, just selling as an old man and can't actually keep up with them, and there's no sloppiness or these weird moments. This crowd does not know what to make of any of this. Like, they don't. I can hear the reactions. They eventually did the, I think we're meant to be, doing the dueling chants now. That's what I felt. I didn't really feel through the TV screen a proper emotional split reaction. Oh, this is unbearable. This, the two guys I really like don't like each other and they are sort of threatening one another, or, you know, I didn't feel conflict. I just felt like they thought, oh, that's a cute, to make some noise because they're talking loudly. Because I don't know, I honestly don't know what they're talking about. I'm not an idiot. I can infer some of the things that haven't been, like, it's not, no one said the quiet part loud match. No one said the quiet part loud yet. I'm confused. I'm literally confused talking about this. Try and let this give us a minute. What on earth was Hangman Page? I understand what he was doing to a degree. He's alluding to the fact that the CM Punk that everyone loves isn't quite the nice, principled guy that you'd like to believe. Hence the line about, and Hangman Page believes himself to be, that's why he feels like he can defend AEW from, it's Carny succubus adjacent. He didn't outright say it, but he's kind of thinking, there's way more for Carny guys. I'm your real hero. And I'm kind of really resentful of the fact that Punk's making himself out to be something he isn't. But I'm too good to actually say that, thus proving my point. He's saying all of the, it's just not getting through in the messaging at all. And he conveyed this or alluded to it by saying, you talk about workers' rights, if only people knew, or something to that effect. That just makes me resent Paige a bit more.
It's the worst part of a night out when somebody says, if you knew things about that, well, you've got to tell me now then. You've got to leave that teaser hanging, and then there's, I couldn't possibly say anymore.
That is an absolutely
amazing... Like, that is amazing, the worst part of a night out when somebody says that, and Paige just did it.
That is an amazing take, because when someone says, oh, I've got a great story or a great bit of gossip, oh, maybe I shouldn't tell you. Piss off. Yeah. It's the most annoying thing. And that is an amazing take. That's exactly what he did. So not only did he withhold that sort of, oh, come on, give us some more of this. Not only did he withhold that information, but he kind of made himself out to be a hypocrite. Who out of Hangman Page and CM Punk started a wrestlers union?
Neither.
So why is the other one, like,
moral high ground in the first game, yeah.
They're both champagne socialists. Yeah. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I like the idea that there are principled people in this rotten game, but... Are there? Like, seriously, are there? I don't think there is. I would like to believe it, and it's the curve of WWE works wonderfully in AEW's favor, as we've discussed across several different controversies over its 3-year lifespan. Don't talk about how one person's faking pretending about the workers, when if you look down the line of incidents that CM Punk, if he really cared, could have just stepped in and had a word publicly when he's not punching down on Ryan Satin. Who deserves it? But you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, easy targets. See, it's not as if Hangman Page is the leader of the wrestling union either. Like, what are you talking about? It just was so unfocused. I couldn't infer enough from this. Maybe I'm being stupid,
no,
or maybe it's gone over my head, or maybe these two have had an absolute nightmare when it comes to constructing the story. And I honestly think at this point, these two have had an absolute meh trying to do whatever it is they're trying to do.
Gave me flashbacks when I was at university and someone would be talking about something that I thought I had a decent grasp on, and then they'd say something, whether it be political or, you know, course-based or whatever, and I'd just have to go, I don't know. I sort of get where you're aiming at here, but I'm not on that road with you.
David Mitchell and Pete are going, chance to be a fine thing, over and over again, because it's all he has to say, because yes. He doesn't actually know what's happening. There was one thing I forgot to mention, and Cedric reminded me there when he was analysing that. The point about, was it when, I sat on that stage and it's like, yeah, well, I paved the way. Punk and Hangman Page arguing over how we all got here. Like, was like, oh, this should have been you and Cody and it would have been better and it would have been real. And instead you're doing the diet version of it because Cody's gone now and you've got to do it with a champion instead. Like, that's somebody else's feud that you're having. And like, even Cody's little line, I shouldn't do the Punk thing now, you know, like, that's got more heft and gravitas than Page trying to do it as the World Heavyweight Champion. That was Cody's story, and you've farted it out here instead.
I was just left very confused. Very confused. What would the casual fan make of this?
That's a good point.
The hardcore fan doesn't really know what to make of it.
Yeah.
I've had people online, in other people's replies, some of mine, do you not get it? This is what's happening. Do you not get it? No, this is actually what's happening. I've had like 8 different responses. Well, I don't think anyone knows. I think people can kind of get that he believes that CM Punk is a charlatan. Mm. And if this is the story, and CM Punk is going to turn heel, can he not just turn heel having believed in the babyface stuff, but then something's happened in the storyline that's made him revert to his own ways? I don't want to undo the heft of the first dance. It was absolute magic. I don't want to think of CM Punk all this time being the charlatan or whatever, and then now that I've sniffing the title, which is the reason why I came back, now I can reveal my true colours. So this is a guy who spoke compassionately about stan culture and about people's capacity to change and about addiction and alcohol issues. Why undo all of that for the sake of I'm a snake old man sort of thing? You know what I mean? Just why bother? You can turn heel in a different way. So if it's leading to that, I wouldn't like that either.
Absolutely.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Then we got a video package hyping up the TBS Championship match for Double or Nothing between Jade Cargill and Anna Jay. Jay saying she's learned from the veterans on the roster since they last faced, and she's ready to be the best. And Jay said, hey, I already beat her. It'll be easy.
They had a very good match, and it is that that has got me even remotely interested in the Double. Like, this is a lie. This is absolute bollocks video package stuff over the top of a few that otherwise doesn't exist. And, you know, like, it's one thing to, we praise WWE's amazing production or their video. If you only ever watch one show a month and it's the PLE, you get these incredible video packages. I should watch more TV because this stuff's amazing. It's like, no, it's not. Please, just stick with these. Like, I like Anna Jay and Jade Cargill and think this might work, But I know when I'm watching a turd being polished, and that's what's happening for me.
Obligatory. Yes. One word, obligatory. They had a great match on Rampage, a total over-delivery, and instead of building a story, they've just thought, oh, let's run that back.
Yeah.
No work, but run it back. It's pathetic.
Then we got Private Party versus John Moxley and Eddie Kingston on commentary was a wizard. And my soon-to-be new best friend, William Regal, I am interviewing him this afternoon. So if by chance you've listened to this podcast in the few hours since we recorded it and before like 5 p.m. here in the UK, please do send me any questions you'd like me to ask him at Adam Wilborn on Twitter. But that will be out in the next few days, hyping up Double or Nothing, of course. So yeah, Moxley and Kingston face Private Party. They attack before the bell, dominate early on. They get a bit of offense into Quinn and Cassidy. Hot tag from Quinn after an Enziguri. They hit some big Private Party dives. Cassidy hit a diving stunner and Quinn landed a shooting star press for a two after we go for a break, I believe. Party go for the silly string, but Kingston hits the Hurricane and Moxley does that clubbing thing, just die. I'm going to hit you with elbows until you pass out, basically. And then it's academic, but he hits him with the paradigm shift for the 1-2-3. And as anticipated, immediately after the match, the Jericho Appreciation Society run down and try and beat him down to set up the Anarchy in the Arena. I was trying to remember what it was called there for Sunday, of course. Santana Ortiz, Brian Danielson run down to even the odds. Big brawl, big separation. Your thoughts on all this, Sige?
Obligatory. Obligatory stuff.
Yeah.
Like the match, the win, the post-match beat down. It's pretty formula at this point. I did actually enjoy the action, and I want to really shout out Isaiah Cassidy. Some of his bumping is so great. He just looks like he's been killed. You can do that wonderful. It looks like not only have you taken really like gruesome impact throw to the head, but looks like your ankles have been broken at the same time because it's messed up your whole body. It's not just army booty bonds. You look like you've actually snapped your ankles back, like you're so good at bumping. It was so much more polished. Like Private Party, again, the problem with this company is there's too many fucking wrestlers in it. Because Private Party, in spite of like that limited window in which to be able to perform, much less get over, has narrowed and narrowed and narrowed, they've still got way, way, way better
yes.
in these heel roles, and they should be doing so much more. And
it was such a weird... It was quite, oh my God, is that Private Party? And they came out, and the Andrade office thing. And I was like, oh yeah, that's a thing still, yeah. isn't it?
So I did enjoy this. Again, though, like, save, especially when it as it pertains to the Blackpool Combat Club, when the entire genius premise of this storyline is that because Moxley and Danielson have been so well established that getting hopes that like the Walters of a stable. My old thing about Walter is if you got a hope spot against Walter, it was just as good as like a win or a whatever. Yes. So that's how dominant he was. Because Moxley and Danielson are so credible, because they can pace and work matches so well, that's how they got Yuta over. Is the second he starts to show a bit of fire one week, a bit more the next. He's got their number the third and fourth. It's like magic. I think they are squandering the near falls. It was evident in Rampage. I know it's Kingston, but still Combat Club. But across the Moxley-Danielson Rampage match and the Moxley-Kingston Dynamite match, like Moxley in particular is being a little bit too given. If the whole idea is you might even get inducted into the super credible gang if you can go toe-to-toe with them or take a beating, they should be very selective about the near falls in anything involving Moxley and or Danielson. Nothing is about the post-match. I've seen a million beatdowns at this point in my life. Like 1 million run-ins and beatdowns.
Yeah, like to go back to the point I made at the start, this is the go-home.
I know it's wrestling. You have to do that.
You do. It's obligatory is the word again. Like I'm just not, no pun intended, fired up for this match on Sunday. But AEW have shown us Anarchy in the Arena without having to tell us about it. Like, the Inner Circle versus Men of the Year was half decent. The one with friggin' Sting and the lads was unreal at the last pay-per-view, and I couldn't have been less interested. That was the Andrade family office and all that's gone on for ages, and then they just have this total chaotic ripper. So without having to label it as such, these pay-per-view ones have tended to rule. So you absolutely have to give this the benefit of the doubt, but it's not left me feeling particularly energised.
We got a couple of video packages, decent video packages, to hype up the two semi-finals in the Owen Hart Cup. And then former Sunderland manager Priest Coleman joined commentary. I thought you'd like that. Coleman joined commentary.
One of the highlights of Sunderland Till I Die on Netflix, which I can not really recommend, but is Chris Coleman getting shouted at by a Sunderland fan. We're bottom of the table. Everything's going awfully, awfully wrong. And somebody says, "All right, Chris, you prick." And Chris Coleman just stops in his track, says, "You call me? You call me a prick? I'm my mum with six kids, and you call me a prick?" As if there are stipulations to what makes someone a prick.
Anyway, this was the Ring of Honor tag team title match, FTR versus Roppongi Vice. Nice early exchanges from Rocky Romero and Cash Wheeler. Cross arm breaker forces Cash to roll out to the floor. Then Dax and Trent even come in. And more physical stuff here. Hard chop exchanges. Cash getting an assisted elbow drop for a two count. Rocky gets a blind tag and there's a half and half suplex from Trent to get a two count and takes to a break. When we come back, Dax gets the hot tag, fights off both of them, and Trent manages to recover and whip Dax into the turnbuckle. German suplexes to Dax until he can fight back and hit some of his own. And there's a bridging pin that Rocky Romero jumps on top of to break it all up. Then it looks like Roppongi might have the titles won. They hit a rising double knees on Dax. There's a Rocky making sure that Cash can't get involved. There's the diving drop kick. Trent hits his sliding lariat. That gets a two count. Trent and Dax repeat sort of cradling each other. And then they manage to hit a sort of strong zero for a near fall. I think that was the point where one of them got pushed into the pile to break it all up. I believe it was Rocky who got knocked into Dax getting pinned by Trent. Anyway, in the midst of all this, who should run down but Invaders from New Japan, Jeff Cobb and the Great Okan.
Why's that pop me?
I've already written down in the notes. Invading.
It's so expressive, though.
The United Empire, as they are known in New Japan. Run down, attack, DQ, and both teams just get laid out by... nice to see Jeff Cobb back in AEW, by Jeff Cobb and the Great Okan. Tour of the Islands by Cobb on Dax, I believe, and then he powerbombed him through a table. And Okan does the claw slam to Trent on a table to the outside to put him through that, and then they stand tall with the Ring of Honor.
Trent did a good job putting himself at a table, didn't
he? Tag titles, yeah. What do you think of this? A DQ, but I think you pointed this out on Twitter, but I'm sure the superfans,
the mega fans
even, will forgive me.
I'll forgive you for that as well, you cock.
Indeed. But about the fact that sporadically, it's DQs, not fine, but they're bearable. And did you think it worked in this scenario?
In context, greatly. In context, and in execution, and in everything, and in scarcity as well.
Yes.
Three DQs in one show.
And Tony Khan's super cute, and this is technically a Ring of Honor DQ.
Yeah, I know.
Because it was a Ring of Honor match.
But seriously, it's on Dynamite, it's the same thing. Unfortunately, it is the same thing. There's a difference. There's some really good... and one little bit bad about this, but the bad is macro. Let's talk about the micro of the match. Some of this wrestling was great.
Yeah.
So physical, and they told such a good story, and it was so well executed, and there's so many lovely little moments throughout that I was really on the hook for this. And then when they took it away from me through an actual transgression by an invading force who wouldn't give a toss about the rules in AEW, the promotion they want to appear better than ahead of the Forbidden Door, A disqualification in this context is absolutely perfect. They're not going to have any repercussions. They're not going to get, docked at the pay window or anything for this. It was perfect, and at the same time, they told such a great story of how Roppongi Vice felt as good as FTR in this match that it's various points. One, I bought the finish. The stack pin... and collapsing that was just so perfectly timed. It was beautiful. Heart was in the mouth. And the fact that it was trending in the direction of, I'm losing myself in this finish. This is awesome. I don't know who's going to win. And then they remove the doubt again by ruining the match for you. Again, do it once in a blue moon, and it actually works as a transgression. Cobb and Okan's stuff didn't actually look that great. Cobb did. Okan, not so much in the post-match. But, maybe it was jitters. Cash Wheeler actually using the ropes, not as something to run around to make cool things happen, but as something to launch himself off to deliver a drop kick. He just uses it as a weapon. Cash Wheeler's so goddamn underrated. He's amazing. But I want you to think about this, Wilborn. Remember the segment. Great O'Conn and Jeff Cobb come in, right? Contrast this with the first time you saw Jeff Cobb in AEW. It felt like the world had broken in the most wonderful way. It felt so shocking. It felt so out of nowhere. It felt amazing. It
Jericho
felt
like, bring him in.
Yeah, it's part of the inner circle. He was the mercenary to have the match with
Moxley.
Yeah.
It was like amazing. You just thought, my God, they've just broken something, and it's great. It's like the distortion from Creep on Radiohead, where it's like, it just feels like a mistake, but it's better. And it's like, this shouldn't be happening, but no, it should, because it's awesome. Jeff Cobb's third appearance in AEW, yeah, the debut, the beatdown, then the subsequent match, which ripped, and now this is his third one all these years later, right? It follows cameos and Forbidden Door openings or whatever from W. Morrissey, Johnny Elite, and Big Damo. Those three names in succession are damning. It feels like Tony Khan is obsessed with surprises and shocks, irrespective of who these people are, because Johnny Elite, there are John Morrison stands, Big Damo, really rate him. He was the star of War Games, the best War Games match in NXT. To this day, he was the star of it. I don't want to see him as Big Damo. Maybe if they went 3 months without any of this. Mm. Oh, that's cool. That's Big Damo. Oh, there's a guy.
Yeah.
And it's just Jeff Cobb's appearance here just really brought into focus for me, in contrast to his first two appearances, just how much the novelty of all of this is dead. And guess what? Forbidden Door is sold on this novelty. So what a weird time to do W. Morrissey, Damo, and Johnny Elite. Maybe one, not three, ahead of Forbidden Door. Like, he's, I think Tony Khan's lost the plot at times.
It's perhaps a little bit too inconvenient as well. I'm speculating here, so I don't want to like create a nightmare if it's not even going to happen. But it is my belief off the back of this that O'Conn and Jeff Cobb will probably, I looked at this morning and I've already forgotten, shame on me. I think it's Baddock Farley and Chase Owens are the IWGP tag champions.
You're right, yeah.
They've got a match coming up.
Because they held the New Japan tag titles for like 22 days, I think.
This feels very neat and tidy that they will now win those belts. And, oh, who wanted the IWGP titles? FTR. Oh, who's just been attacked? Oh, here's this match. Like, it's quite convenient if we suddenly arrive on these two teams facing each other after this run-in and after this attack. So, bit of a shame that we've had to witness it happen through like a couple of botches from the Great O'Conn as well. Like, the kind of the stuff that will be flagged as, that was less than ideal when it was supposed to be this domineering beatdown. But I'm going to end this little section on a positive. I was quite harsh on the build to this match, and the matches need to exist. And yet FTR are clearly in such luxurious form that when you watch a caramel smooth match like this, you're like, oh, it just doesn't matter.
Yes.
Put FTR out there at the moment because they're just wrestling, like, hair ruffling comment this, but they're wrestling their bloody little hearts out. Like, everything they're doing is so, so good at the moment. Midas touch stuff, that this match was great. FTR versus Jeff Cobb and Great O'Connell, probably be great. So it doesn't matter if it all feels a little bit fake and a little bit contrived and, oh, why are we doing this? Oh, you can see why we're doing this. Oh, it's convenient how all the belts have worked out. Put all the belts on them because they're the best. If anything, scrap a couple of matches and double or nothing, give them an impromptu. Like, I'll take that at this point because I want to watch FTR wrestle. They're just in such great form that you're seeing the reason why it's still worth shaping things around them. But fundamentally, and with Sidgwick, like, you've created such an expectation for these surprises that even when they occur, unless they're absolute blockbuster knockout of the park surprises, it's just like, yeah, this is what happens on AEW. And that's a less than ideal situation to be in.
Mm. Right, then we got the Hardys backstage talking about the Young Bucks. Similar upbringings, but once they broke into the Union, their similarities ended. The Bucks don't have the fortitude to success like the Hardys did. Matt Hardy talked about, you want to talk about the Elite? We'll talk about the Delete. And they'd say that the Bucks are just Hardy cosplayers. They're the goats. Jeff Hardy does a goat impression in here. And said that the Bucks were just stepping stones on their way to become tag champs. And the Bucks weren't even better babies than them. I forgot to mention that. The saying is never meet your heroes, but in this case, the Bucks, Michael Hamflett, will never beat their heroes. Fantastic wordplay, that.
And they've already done it. And they've done it in Tony Khan's Ring of Honor. Like, that's happened. The Young Bucks are beat. I didn't like this at all, right? What am I supposed to take from it? Like, was Matt Hardy intentionally deluded in the bollocks that he was spouting here? Because half of it was a lie. Like, they've, and not just pedantic wrestling fans beat them. Like, this whole thing about the Young Bucks wouldn't have made it, like, you know, the Hardys were better built for, like, the olden times and the way that Young Bucks wouldn't be now. Like, I get what he's alluding to there. I do. You know, they don't drink good Christian boys, all that stuff. Like, when the Hardys went off that beaten track, everything went to shit for them. Like, it was getting back on it and getting back to the likes of wrestling with the Young Bucks that kind of saved the souls of the Hardy boys multiple times over to put them in a position where they are now. Like, was Matt Hardy trying to present himself as a deluded heel? Is this just that, like, generic wrestling dream match? The characters don't matter. Like, I just did not care for this.
I think it's that latter one.
And the Young Bucks are still, like, I like this slow burn Young Bucks babyface turn, but then they kind of betrayed that in setting this match up by still being, like,
say, how slow is this?
Dickhead heels in the beatdowns. So, I the match graphic is...
It's either that or Matt Jackson acting conflicted melodramatically about whatever he wants to do to his hero. So
the match graphic is doing, like, impossibly, like, large amounts of heavy lifting. And even then, for some, I don't think that's enough. I think this match feels like it's for the Young Bucks, so it's happening.
I was shockingly high on this, given that I just don't like the Hardy Boys. I'm not, like, 15 years old anymore, 36. Like, I understand. And I admire, like, loyalty. Obviously, fan culture in general is so, like, toxic. And I just thought, like, come on. Just like what you like. Don't pretend that everything's automatically good because this thing that you used to like is still good. I don't get it, but I guess it's nice. Maybe it makes me feel a little bit inhuman that I bumped loads for me, but did it years ago. just don't care.
It's the Jericho thing you always say, isn't it? When he's on a down cycle, it's like sort of, oh God, this idiot again.
Yeah, then the guy's taking, like, more bumps than I've probably ever watched in my life. It's like, nah. But I know the story was patronizing. And I've got another problem with it. But I just thought the delivery was just so good that I thought, you're good, Carnies. Well done. Well done. I'll tell you what my problem with this is, right? And I thought, again, the delivery was going to make me like a team that I just don't really care about. You know, Matt Hardy, I've had to endure him for, like, 2 years at this point. And I think I've enjoyed him twice. But this is thrice now, so well done. I've read the Young Bucks autobiography, right? In it, they talk about how much it meant to them to wrestle the Hardys, how much it drew to Ring of Honor, and how it felt like a career peak because it proved that they were good enough to wrestle and earn the respect of their heroes. It was just a thrill to be able to do that. And their match at Supercard of Honor, I think it was in 2017, had drawn what was, to that point, ROH's biggest house, right? And then we all know what happened on that weekend. They worked a second consecutive ladder match in 24 hours in WWE. And Matt and Nick, in their autobiography, just expressed their acceptance that, right, of course you're going to go to WWE. You're not going to stay at work a program with just us. Like, we're not that, we're play brats, but we're not dickheads. But yeah, we completely understood, endorsed, encouraged, or whatever the decision. Absolutely fine. We just wish we could have done more with the Hardy Boys, right? So why are they doing the exact same thing? What? Where's the more? Oh, we could have done more. And the sample points out, they've got the footage if they wanted to say, all right, this is where the story left off. But it was never more than a intergenerational mirror match. And they're just repeating it again because they realize that's not much bloody more of the story, is there, at all? But, you know, I didn't hate them, which is the curve of how much I just don't like the Hardy Boys at all. Really helped.
There's there's a massive, massive spectrum in terms of the quality of this match on Sunday, isn't there? Like, they could really pull this one out and it could be totally awesome. Or,
well, maybe it was encouraging because they realized, oh, we're past our prime. We're absolutely thrashed. We're absolutely cooked, but we've got, like, a lot of professional pride and all the rest of it. Like, if they do bits where, like, Matt Hardy is, like, crawling around the is crawling around the mat, mirroring Jeff, just be absolutely goosed and, like, taking the piss out of how broken they are, and then they make the comeback. Like, there's loads that can do.
Yeah.
It's the Bucks. Like, I would honestly think the Bucks, give them 20 minutes on pay-per-view against the Miz and Braun Strowman, I think they could work a really I think they could work a really great match against those two absolute I don't know what they are, but they're not good, are they?
What's the Young Bucks book called? Killing the Business.
Killing the Business.
It's genuinely one of the best books out there that isn't Michael Sidgwick's Becoming All Elite, The Rise of AEW, which is available on Amazon right now. There you go. Let's talk about the three-way. It was Jungle Boy, Ricky Starks, and Swerve Strickland ahead, of course, of the six-man tag match at the pay-per-view. Immediately, they should start trading roll-ups. And then, because these three just work so well together, Swerve popped Jungle Boy into a Hurricanrana from Ricky Starks, but then Starks trips Jungle Boy up and hits a lariat on the floor and voids a Swerve dive and sends him into the barricade. All this stuff happens. Takes us to a break where we come back. There's an apron Hurricanrana from Jungle Boy on Swerve. They get back in the ring and Jungle Boy hits that sliding elbow of his to the back of Swerve's head. That gets a two count. He hits a sort of Olympic slam on Ricky Starks to get another two count. Oh, I love this spot. Jungle Boy and Swerve are fighting on the top rope. Starks tries to get involved and piss off you. He gets shoved off and Jungle Boy's like, right, reverse Hurricanrana off the top. This will make show this dickhead what I'm about. Does it. Swerve lands on his feet because he's just mint and they just crowd love it. And, you know, whose house? It's Swerve's house. And I just, why would you release him, WWE? Look at what you could have had. Anyway, Swerve goes for a big vertical suplex, but as he's got Jungle Boy up in the air, in comes Starks, hits him with a spear. He follows that with a Michinoku driver to get a two count on Jungle Boy. I think he pokes Swerve in the eye, hits the Rochambeau, but Jungle Boy gets involved and puts Starks in the snare trap. And I don't think I've seen anyone sell the snare trap quite as well as Ricky Starks does. Just oh no, I'm going to die here, scrambling, trying to get to the ropes. He does, but Jungle Boy pulls him back in. But as he looks like he's going to make Ricky Starks submit, Swerve breaks it up, jumping thrust kick, Swerve stomp on Ricky Starks, 1, 2, 3. Swerve Strickland wins this match. Full momentum heading into the pay-per-view. And then, as anticipated, post-match, Powerhouse Hobbs come down. He attacks Swerve. He attacks Jungle Boy. Luchasaurus runs down to make the save. And then, greetings, rings out around the arena. I don't know. That's not his theme.
Imagine if that was his sting.
Yeah.
Greetings!
That'd be so good. Keith Lee comes down. Hobbs gets sent out with a Luchasaurus tail whip. And then Keith Lee hits a sort of slingshot dive onto Hobbs and Luchasaurus on the floor.
It's like a tornado.
Yeah. And then he stands tall with Swerve, raises his arms in the air. Notes on this one, Sige?
I liked this so much more than I thought I was going
Me
to.
Me too.
It was meant to do two things, and it did one because it's never going to do the second thing. It was meant to, in storyline, establish who has the momentum going into it. By like 2 minutes of like ridiculously like silly but great multi-man sequences on the pay-per-view, you're going to completely forget who won this match. So it didn't really need to exist. But it did make me realize, hang on, this is going to be absolutely class when it happens. And I thought, without being blow away great in that sort of intoxicating, oh, I'm losing myself in an amazing match way, good, because that's for the pay-per-view. This is meant to give you the tiniest glimpse. I thought it was measured perfectly. I was besotted by Ricky Starks in a sense of showmanship. He just looked like the biggest star in the world.
Yep.
On a show that is particularly hard to feel like a star, as I've mentioned quite a lot during this podcast. I was besotted with him. Swerve Strickland ended his best individual performance yet. He was absolutely magnificent. Jungle Boy was genuinely great in a less sort of flashy, eye-catching way, but you know, he's really great at sort of just tethering everything together, being in the right place at the right time for maximum dramatic effect for the saves and the counters. The post-match was really entertaining for once, because sometimes it just feels like a blurry hailstorm of fists and things to do, because that's how you advance a story. Keith Lee did the most memorable thing in a post-match I can recall in AEW for quite some time. All of this made something that's flawed and not great feel like the best version of an imperfect thing is going to happen on Sunday night.
It sold the tag match for me, and that's exactly what it was there for.
That's it, yeah. This was as good a match as it was an effective hype job, and it was just nice to see those two things coming together in a way that didn't feel forced. As forced as the arrangement of this match did in the first place, it did away with all of that feeling of, this is fake, this isn't it? You know, because by the end of it, I was completely bang game for the tag match based on this little shop window to what I'd been saying. One of the sort of low-key success stories of this episode, and a nice reminder that AEW's brand of, like, we have talked a lot on podcasts going back years about good wrestling just not being enough anymore, and it isn't. But AEW's brand of good wrestling is very, very good, and sometimes can be, and I think they know they've got that. I don't think the tag match on Sunday will steal the show, nor do I think those are the expectations, by the way, but I don't think it will steal the show. But I think they were trying to tell you through this match and post-match that they're going to try, and they've got the ability to do it. And I just think AEW's, for all the criticisms of the roster bloat and the misuse of certain talent, I think this is a reminder of, like, I know it's only 3 years old. The old soul of AEW. This is still fundamentally what it exists for, was something like this.
And before we move on, if you're a fan of Ricky Starks, and if you're not, what's wrong with you? He's going to be getting interviewed by the brilliant Andrew Pollard later on today. If you want to send him a question just before about 6 o'clock UK time, he's not got a great deal of time. You can send it to him at CulturedLeftPeg on Twitter. He's chatting to Ricky Starks and to Jamie Hayter, in fact. We get a promo backstage from Dan Lambert and the Men of the Year, and no one got slut shamed once. He just said, "Oh, what do you think you're doing, Sammy Guevara? Smashed up his title belt. That's not going to do anything. You're not going to get the match you wanted. In fact, not talking to you, love." he says, "It's not going to get you a match you wanted, and I run American Top Team. Of course I can get belts. I've got everyone on speed dial. It's a piece of piss. I'm going to give Scorpio Sky his new belt on AEW Rampage. What could possibly go wrong there?" Well, we'll talk about that on the preview on Friday.
The quality of a segment.
Right, a bit of a test here next up for both of you. I know particularly you, Hamfler, you're a bit of a wrestling encyclopedia. You've got a great memory for wrestling. Do you remember the AEW Women's World Champion? Because AEW finally did here. They have Thunder Rosa finally coming out and doing something. She comes out to cut a promo ahead of her match with Serena Deeb, but she's got no face paint on. She's got a cowboy hat instead. She's got no face paint on, though, because this is the real her, and she wanted people and Serena to see what a champion looked like. And then on Sunday, she's going to be wearing the war paint. Serena Deeb's never going to look like her, she said. And she talks about the fact that she's just bitching and moaning all the time. And she used to look up to Serena Deeb. And she's going to make Serena Deeb pay for the disrespect. And then she pauses and goes to do the wrap-up segment. And they, I don't know, when you go too long at the Oscars, they start playing the music there, basically. It was just a mess, this.
Well, I liked how she just decided, "Oh, I've still got my promo to finish. Do not rush me off. Do not rush me off. I'm not finished talking."
Please let this bang on the pay-per-view. I don't think the build-up's been anywhere near. It's sold a match based on the idea that these are the two best women fighting for the promotion's top title. And that's just about all it's done. And that's not enough, realistically,
no.
Is it?
No.
It does feel like a women's wrestling story.
Yeah.
I will say that I do like. I mean, I can't really talk. I can't really speak for that. But from my perspective, it does.
There was a point, wasn't there, when Thunder Rosa had beaten Nyla Rose, and she said something along the lines of, "Right, I'm only going to fight like proper in-ring contenders anymore. I'm not going to," because they'd like had some like pyro and ballyhoo, as Vince Russo would say, that set us up for that match. It's not going to be about that. It's going to be about the wrestling. They have at least lived up to that, but it was only a very small detail, and it's not really something that's been dwelled on since. So I'm not even sure if that's just my headcanon rather than a detail that they've put in place. So this was supposed to be all about who is the better wrestler, and Serena Deeb's comments are supposed to be about, it's not about like what, cutting my hair or satisfying the perverts or anything like that. And Thunder Rosa was saying that too. It's not about what we say to each other in the build-up. I'm going to put wall paint on, and it's about the wrestling match. So if the wrestling match is awesome, all of the brief has kind of been satisfied. But again, you can kind of see that AEW as a company is still kind of faking it till they make it a little bit.
Yeah, like, it does feel like a women's wrestling story, and I think that they could have handled, just shave 2 minutes off the men's match in the main event. You've done it before. Mm. Do it quite a few weeks, actually, when the pacing's out of control. So just let her finish.
Yeah, absolutely. I thought it was just ridiculous that they started doing, like, I guess that's it. Hit the music.
Yeah. You cannot not look undermined when they do that to you.
This was the women's section of AEW Dynamite, because next, Red Velvet's
was
backstage.
Was it an hour and a half into the show?
Yeah, I think it was, looking at the clock. Red Velvet's backstage. She was not happy, obviously, about losing her quarterfinal match, yes, off the top of my head, in the Owen Hart Cup. And in comes Ruby Soho, and she says, "Here's a notebook of information all about how you beat Chris Statlander," because obviously she's got a relationship with her. And Soho said, "I don't need the notebook. I'm up against a new version of Chris Statlander." And that match goes down on AEW Rampage. We'll talk about more of that on the preview on Friday. Then it was time for the semi-final in the women's division. Britt Baker versus Toni Storm. Early on, technical exchange from back and forth stuff from the both of them. They brawl to the outside, and Storm gets sent face first into these steel steps to take us to commercial. When we come back, Storm makes a comeback, swinging DDT and a hip attack. She hits an Alabama slam, but Baker counters Storm Zero into an air raid crash. That gets her a two count. Then Jamie Hayter appears, walks down the ramp, and you think, what shenanigans are going to happen here? She exchanges some words with Britt Baker. In the midst of all this, Storm rolls up Britt Baker, but she gets out of it and hits Storm manages to hit her with a release German suplex. There's a tornado DDT off the apron. Baker gets planted on the floor. In the midst of all this, this is when you start seeing, because I noticed it first because I saw the referee putting his gloves on. So I was like, well, someone's busted open. It was Toni Storm. She might have a broken nose, they were talking about on commentary. Haters knocking about, though. So Storm knocks her off the apron and Baker rolls up Toni Storm and holds onto the ropes. And I think, I'm not sure whether Hate was meant to be involved. It was all a bit of a mess, this. But regardless, Britt Baker pins Toni Storm. She advances to the final to face the winner, as I said, of Ruby Soho versus Chris Statlander on AEW Rampage. Your thoughts on this match?
I didn't understand the finish. I don't think it was botched. I think what they were going for was a slight intentional delay. Like the ambition, the timing, the intended timing of the spot was ambitious, because I think it was meant to come across like Hayter had waited until the last second to actually do it, stemming potentially from the fact that wrestling being wrestling, pretty much since day one, there's been this, are they going to probably split up at some point angle. But that did, maybe I'm being generous, it was just botched, I've got any idea. Particularly since they've been kind of pally again.
Yes.
After it really feeling like they were breaking up and then not. I'd love to watch. I might actually sit down and watch a Dynamite from just 5 months ago just to see how much is informed, what followed, because it just feels all over the place at the minute. Quality of the work was not particularly good.
No.
Toni Storm looked good individually. I can't say as much about Britt Baker. There was a point where it just felt, and this is probably extraordinarily harsh, but I'm going to say it, it felt NXT 2.0 level when Storm Zero was reversed into the air raid crash. Mm-hmm. It didn't feel like she was firing up and no selling it. It just felt like she'd simply taken a move and then was going to take another move and then just countered it. Didn't feel like she was firing up. It didn't look like she was really smartly countering something. It just felt like they had a move to do in an order, in a certain order, and then just did it without any of the emotion informing why you were able to pop straight back up. Just felt like poor, piss poor selling.
And a lot of people not happy online that Toni Storm didn't win this match.
Yeah, I don't know about that.
I wanted this to be the final. Well, this should yesterday. Be the final.
Absolutely.
Yeah, like this.
Glad it wasn't.
Yeah, maybe. Like this was, I'm probably just like echoing Cedric's point there. This felt way more cooperative than it was competitive, which is less than ideal. We have different reads, myself and Cedric, on this finish, which suggests that whichever one of us is right or wrong, or neither of us might be, it's not ideal because Everybody's supposed to get the gist. I thought Hayter was supposed to help and it was just a botch because Toni Storm had made a comment, hadn't she, that like, do not do your usual dirty tricks, do not screw me, otherwise there's going to be absolutely hell to pay. And then they've kind of done it anyway. Britt Baker has yet again relied on her mates, so as a result...
Or was Hayter worried about the threat of Toni Storm, and that's why she dithered a little bit?
So we've got three separate... it's been, at very least, it's been too ambitious in its scope, because We've... Like, I've read it as a botch. Sidger's found two very logical ways in which it might not have been a botch, but it's not presented itself clearly enough for us to infer one of the three.
Mm. Don't get your mates in your stable to help you win, because it just should just be one-on-one, and Britt Baker's gone.
We're going to do it anyway.
I thought it was that. Well, you can say it. Give you the excuse to press the button.
Yeah, so, I'm happy.
Whatever you press the button, what can I press now?
The work wasn't good enough. The work wasn't anywhere near good enough. These tournaments have not been that great. I'm just glad that there's no more tournament action to come on this review. You know?
I've loved like three tournament matches.
And I want Chris Statlander to win, and I feel like I'm being told that Ruby Soho's going to.
Oh, Ruby
like,
Soho's.
Statlander Baker's the better final for me on paper.
And I also don't know whether I don't like this tournament as much as I thought I would, because the people I wanted to win aren't in the finals. Does that make sense? Sometimes I do this, I say before, where a match happens and you guys are heaping praise on it, and I'm a bit like, yeah, but they didn't do the impossible spot that I booked in my head, so I didn't like it as much. I don't know, it's very self-defeatist.
But brackets, yes, I suppose, to generate all these cool thoughts about all these potential combinations and permutations. That's the exciting. That's why tournaments are theoretically great, right? But then the point of, it's wrestling, it's fake. So the point of you constructing these brackets is for people to think these things. And then when you don't deliver these things and you instead go off in different directions, it's like, then you just book the tournament differently then. Like, if that's the way you want to go, find a way to do it where you're not showing all these other things and then providing something different. Like, the King of the Ring 1995 should not have had Savio Vega and Mabel in the final.
No.
When Shawn and The Undertaker are opposite sides of it. All right, don't, like, give people this. We got two stars in this and they're opposite ends of the brackets.
Oh, my God.
Savio Vega and Mabel, baby. Like, that's why people hate that tournament.
Yeah. Anything else you want to say about this?
I was trying to...
Are you going to be having a little play?
Just wait there. None of these buttons fit. Maybe something will organically occur during the main event.
Okay. Wait and see. Right, semi-final. The men's tournament was the main event. It was Samoa Joe versus Cool Cal O'Reilly. Early on, Samoa Joe just stiffs him, just clobbers O'Reilly with a load of strikes and hits him with a chop and a standing elbow drop from Samoa Joe. Gets a two count. O'Reilly starts making a comeback. It's, you know, he talked about this in the road too. He said, "I'll take two to manage to get one." Starts coming back, hitting him with strikes of his own, but gets cut off with a back elbow. But he manages to land a diving knee drop and goes for the armbar to take us to a break. When we come back, Joe's arm has been targeted by Kyle O'Reilly, as he has done previously to Rey Fénix, of course. But he fires back up, hits that running senton, which always looks so good when Joe does it. He hits him with a lariat, that gets him a two count. Sets up for the muscle buster, but O'Reilly fights out of it and puts him in the Fujiwara armbar, which Joe eventually breaks out of. They're trading strikes in the ring. They've got that, it's not called the wacky line, but I forget what it's called, the gimmick where O'Reilly gets hit and goes into the...
It's a rebound.
The middle and the bottom rope, and comes back. Joe hits an enziguri. O'Reilly fires back with a soccer kick. Goes sent into the ropes, counters the STO, rolls Joe up, but Joe kicks out, and I saw a nice thing that said this was similar to what happened with Joe and Styles, I think, in TNA, where he's trying to grab him for the pinfall and he just kicks out of it and simultaneously grabs him into a rear naked choke. And O'Reilly's just, you could just see the panic in his eyes, and he's holding onto that one arm to make sure that the injured arm can't complete the choke. But eventually Joe manages to get it around, chokes Kyle O'Reilly out, gets the victory. He will face Adam Cole in the final, and there's a stare down as Cole walks out on the ramp to close the show.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I thought it was really going to be Kyle O'Reilly versus Adam Cole, so I was left with,
hey,
on my face.
yes.
So, great news. No Samoa Joe versus Jay Lethal on the main card or the pre-show.
I thought that, yeah.
Of Double or Nothing, so that's good. That takes away one match and a Jay Lethal match, which is very good. There was some really nice work, like the arm work, how it informed the finish and just made Joe feel like a badass. That was good. The general mesh of styles, like technique versus power, striking. That was all very good. There was a bit on the outside. I don't know if it was actually during picture-in-picture.
Might have been.
When he smashed him, it looked like he'd caved his chest and it was so hard hitting. But, and I worry about this for the match itself, like Joe's so cooked. Like he's so unbelievably cooked. Like his conditioning is not, I don't dare say, good enough for main event of television, like a singles match on an AEW pay-per-view, when and Danielson can't get one at this point because they are trying to crowbar so much talent under the show. The thing about Samoa Joe is that some of his stuff looks so revolting, and by that I mean beautiful.
Yes.
Because it's so physical and it looks like it really hurts, and this, you know, his whole aura, his presentation, the way he carries himself, it's just awesome. And then 5 minutes into a match, he's gassed, he's sucking air, he's red. Red is a scary colour for an athlete to turn, a fighter to turn. He just looks like he can't do it anymore. And then he does at the end, but he needs a breather midway through. So not only am I thinking, oh, you're not the badass that you used to be, because I'm watching you like visibly suffer and struggle, and not in the way that you're trying to convey a struggle. Just get his arms then. But you then the other person has to sell from, sorry, Joe's having a snooze again. And it's just, I don't want to think about this about Samoa Joe. I just think that he should be in a tag team.
Yeah, I admire that he's paying tribute to the Hart legacy by turning pink in every single match. Like,
oh, wow.
Great tournament run.
But
hey, man, this was his best match in AEW for me so far. Like, I genuinely enjoyed this. Like, it doesn't matter that he looks like Wilborn in the sun when he gives you 10 cool minutes in the main event. I thought this was earnestly good. I enjoyed this from Kyle O'Reilly as well, who I don't think has been in amazing form in AEW so far. This felt the most Samoa Joe is in a fight, and not just because, like, he's looking tired or he's looking like at the tail end of his career. This really, really felt like this attritional battle, this tournament semi-final where it's effectively for all the marbles because you're going to get on pay-per-view. It gave me hope for a match combination that otherwise I'm not that interested in. Samoa Joe, Adam Cole, it's not the hottest thing they could have arrived at for a tournament final.
Get some PWG Cole vibes in this, I think, which I'm looking forward to.
Cole is going to take a really brutal beating to help this, and the body of the match will be made, I think, will be made up of Adam Cole playing counter artist. So Samoa will be trying to trap him in things, will be trying to get him, deck him, and kill him, and Cole will be countering out of it. And that doesn't require Joe to go full tilt in the first 5 minutes. So there's, if you look at this match as the two wrestlers, there's a, you can sort of see how they can arrive at something quite nice over 10 minutes in the tournament, as long as they don't feel the need to get overindulgent and get silly. I think it's quite nice, and then it's quite brutal. So those are both things that could, in combination, make for a decent tournament final.
And you can have him going, set up for Panama Sunrise, and he hits a muscle buster because he's on the in the right place for it.
Yeah. Why not?
Doesn't have to go for it. I'm not like, getting that bonkers.
Or just heads up onto the post.
Yeah, or just lands and Samoa Joe, he goes to flip over Samoa Joe, and Samoa Joe just stays there and picks him up, and Samoa drops him or something. I think there's a really nice dynamic for that final.
Samoa Joe noping a lot of Adam Cole's histrionics is potentially great.
Yeah.
Like in general. Yeah. Like he stands on the corner ready to do the Panama Sunrise, and then Joe like puts his head up and just walks away.
Yeah.
Not tonight. You know, the more I think about it, the more this chemistry might actually work. Yeah. It's just not on paper. It's not quite as attractive as a tournament final as you maybe would have liked.
Not quite the go-home show we were anticipating then from AEW.
Nah. Too many stars.
Article at whatculture.com very soon. But let us know your thoughts ahead of the fallout from AEW Dynamite on Twitter at WhatCultureWWE. Watch there, you can follow all three of us. You can follow Michael Hamflett at
Michael Hamflett.
Follow Michael Sidgwick at
M Sidgwick.
Follow me at Adam Wilborn. Follow us all at WhatCultureWWE. And make sure you subscribe to What Culture Wrestling, wherever you get your podcasts from, for daily wrestling podcasts. We'll be back later on today to look ahead to Double or Nothing. And of course, as I've mentioned before, myself and Michael Hamflett, we'll be doing the live stream for Double or Nothing on Sunday night on our YouTube channel, so make sure you join us for that one, and watch out for our interviews coming very soon with the likes of Ricky Starks, Jamie Hayter, and William Regal. But for now, this has been the AEW Dynamite Review. My thanks to the Dadley Boys. Thank you for joining us, and we will see you soon.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.